The time is now. The place is virtual. Wait, wait, wait. Good morning. It's 10 o'clock on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News with Ben, Al, Miles, and Lindsay. In the second half, Rick the Man Filman will answer phone calls. So you can call in with questions about technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now for Geek Speak.
So you're living in a world that you don't know nothing about. Sitting at your keyboard paralyzed with doubt. So just sit tight, we're here to help you out. We don't know it all, but we'll tell you what we found out. And if it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell.
You're not powerless, we'll give you choices.
The song that's playing right now is by Michael Saunders. Thank you for your contribution. If you want to contribute to the show, please feel free to go to geekspeak.org and send us imagery and audio, music preferred.
So if it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or anyone who works for KOSP. Heck, these views are ours and ours alone. And whose are they? Well, in the air room with me is Al Luckow, new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
Ben Jaffe, independent consultant and trainer. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
We also have Miles Elam, slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Lindsay Loney, and engineering support specialist. I kind of made that up last night.
That works for me.
Oh, good.
Good morning.
Good morning. We'll start off, Ben, you mentioned you had a brief thing.
Oh, yeah. What's going on with me? I am going to go to Europe on Tuesday, assuming the huge volcano over in Iceland stops exploding and stopping all air traffic. But I just wanted to mention, maybe this makes me geeky, but if I can't go to Europe because of a volcano exploding, that's awesome, right? I mean, of all the things to cancel your trip for...
For strange definitions of awesome.
I don't know. I mean, that's...
Richard Attenborough is stuck in the Arctic Circle because of it.
Yeah.
See, that's kind of awesome.
I mean...
As long as he has food.
World leaders are stuck and unable to go back to their countries because of this thing. That's crazy. I don't know.
All right. Well, thanks. Let us know how Europe goes, and if you have recommendations and thoughts about where Ben should go, or you want to know more about his itinerary, you can send email to geeks.
Yeah.
Hey, just call. Just call if you want to tell them where to go.
Just call right now. Yeah. In the second half.
Another quick thing I wanted to mention, Lyle. What is that over there?
Over where?
Over there on the phonograph.
Yeah, we'll talk about this in a second. I've got an iPad with me today. I've had it for a few days, playing with it and getting to know it. And last week we had a pretty big conversation about Apple's SDK, the software development kit, having new wording that kind of doesn't let Adobe play it in their sandbox. And the more I thought about it after the show, the more I kind of liked the idea of letting people know that I really feel like hardware platforms shouldn't restrict what software goes on it. If you buy something, you should put something on. You should be able to put anything you want on it. And that was kind of what I was doing a devil's advocate with Ben and Miles on. But I was kind of listening to it, and I was kind of being a jerk. So I want to apologize for that and let you know that I feel very strongly that it's a bad idea for Apple to make a restrictive software environment, even though they have the OS pinned down and they're controlling the app environment. I think that in the long run, it's bad for the consumer. Miles, you have more thought on that?
Oh, you were saying lock down the hardware. Yes, you're right. They are locking down the hardware, but that aspect hasn't changed. It's really a software lockdown.
That's true. That's true. And this, right. But you wanted to mention why it's a bad idea for Apple to do that?
This is something that an argument derived from Ars Technica, great site, I highly recommend it, which is if you were to describe how a program worked in English, just plain English, saying, okay, if you press this button, this alert pops up and says these bits of text, and then when you click OK, it goes back to do this other screen. If
you're talking about a spec document for software.
Right. If you wrote a specification document and you wrote out all of that in plain English, I doubt Apple would ever cite you for it, but the language is written in such a way that it can encompass something as innocuous as that, or even as necessary as that, considering spec documents are kind of a necessity for well-running programs.
Right.
Wow.
You get the idea, right, Ben?
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to explain to someone what a programming language is. It's not like a tool. It's not like saying you're using Photoshop versus Picasso.
Right.
Like, it's not...
It's a language that defines action.
Right.
Just like English is a language.
It's an expression of logical set of steps. Yeah.
Right. And it's very restrictive in the sense that the computer's not thinking a lot. You really have to kind of translate directly what you say to bytecode. But that translation, the compiler, is a very specific thing. Once the language is defined, it's going to do what it's supposed to do. And so the language of... And you're right. I mean, there are really simple languages. Like AppleScript actually is one of those that almost has an English form. And if you were to write your code really well in a structured way, it looks like a programming language. Even if you're not describing... None of you are writing code if you're writing a spec that way. So yeah, I agree with the idea. All right, let's... Al, let's talk about why I'm so tired. Go, please, tell us about me.
I thought it'd be, you know, every now and then I come up with something that's sort of semi-educational. And there's a thing that exists now. It's called the Internet Meme. And a meme is actually, it's a term used to describe a concept that spreads quickly via the Internet. It's sort of like a viral video. It's sort of a propagation. It's basic. It's an Internet Meme is simply the propagation of a digital file or hyperlink from one person to another using methods available through the Internet. So like on Facebook or, you know, any social networking and instant messaging, all that kind of stuff. So I have this thing called an Internet Meme, and I think a lot of us are going to think of it more as a viral thing.
Yeah, like Rickrolling. Remember a year ago when GeekSpeak Rickrolled the Central Coast of California?
Sure.
That would be one of the many Internet memes out there.
Right. It was a term first coined, I believe, by Richard Dawkins. It was talking about instead of a propagation of genes, we have there are social propagation of elements.
Yeah.
So we call them memes.
And it comes from the Greek mimetismo and something imitated. But yeah, it's Dawkins that first came.
Yeah, he did that in a book called from 1976. Called the selfish gene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is a thing that exists, and we all know what it is. And, you know, examples, they gave some sort of more social examples, but then there's also just regular things like everybody remembers the dancing baby.
Or the dancing hamsters.
Dancing hamsters, all the different things that you seem to get and everybody seems to know. And you listen to this stuff and you hear people talking about these viral videos and you wonder, why the heck didn't I see that? And there comes a point when you realize you just can't keep up. Unless you're like a student with lots of time, you can't really follow all this stuff. Well, there's some hope out there. I ran across this site called Know Your Meme. And now that you know what a meme is, you know what this site is about. It's kind of like Snopes.
The urban legends debunking.
Yeah. But it's really, it's explaining all these different memes and all the different things.
And their history.
Yeah, and I thought this is an interesting thing because I should really, you know, talk about this kind of thing. And this kind of collects them so you can go in here and look at it. So, you know, I should just go and look at the site just to make sure, you know, if I'm going to talk about a site, I want to make sure it's not some stupid thing that's got one page and I want to make sure. So I just, you know, I just go in there and take, you know, a glance at it, make sure it was worth mentioning on GeekSpeak. Well, 2 hours later, I was still on the website, totally neglected all my other news gathering, didn't record my crazy USB device segment.
But you have one.
I have one. I'll just do a live. And I still couldn't leave the site.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I was starting to get a little bit paralyzed. And so I called Lyle, and it was like 11:30.
Last night
to tell him, check out this site.
Well, no, what you said is, oh, man, I spent 2 hours wasting time on this site. It's really cool, but man. Oh.
Wait, so does this make the site a retrovirus? It just kind of like imprints its own codes on top of your own genetic code?
I think it's an internet narcotic, actually.
Yeah, so thanks, Al, for doing that, because at 11 o'clock, I started looking at it, and I went to sleep at 3. So I'm a little tired.
And then he emailed me.
Oh, I mean, no, it's spreading.
I challenge listeners out there to go to the site. Just look. You know, just look. Just, you know,
get
see the site.
And the first one's always free.
And if you don't see, you know, you're going to see things like photobombing and, you know, the serious cat, the picture. I don't know if you've ever seen
the
serious cat.
I love the one. I want to do this. The money face one. You just fold a dollar, a piece of currency in half, so the bottom half of the face you see, and then you make up the second half of the face.
Oh, I want to do.
I love that one.
So I want to do man babies.
Man babies.
Man babies is so good. They basically
tell you guys, you're looking into the black hole and we're not getting out.
Oh my God.
All right. Well,
aren't these as enjoyable talking about them as doing them?
Now that you've told everybody about this for the next week, there's going to be a drop in productivity across the world.
A serious drop in productivity.
California just went down the tubes.
Yeah.
Oh, and in each one of these memes, they have a little Google analytic chart that displays the interest level over time. So based on what people are searching for, like if you're searching for man babies, you would see, oh, at this time, a lot of people were interested in it, and then it kind of dropped off. So you see this analytical thing.
So the analytical thing, by the way, is done in Flash. And the reason I know that is I spent the entire time on the meme site on the iPad. And, of course, the iPad doesn't work with Flash. So I couldn't see the charts. But what was interesting about it is that I'm now – the iPad to me is synonymous with wasting a lot of time and not being creative and productive. Because as a web developer – when I spend time online, I'm normally adding content and creating. Mm-hmm. And last night, I was just sitting back going,
it's just totally exhausting. I mean, I got to somehow put a block on it for my own safety because...
The other thing is I turned off the sound features on the phone, so the iPad, so that it doesn't make clicking sounds. Mm-hmm. So I'm not actually clicking at all. I'm more smearing. So the iPad, I was smearing the website. It's more than clicking the website.
Well, the link will be up on geekspeak.org. It's called Know Your Meme, and it'll be up after the show. So you may want to just go and check it out. And I challenge you to just be there for – maybe people should write in and say, I was there for only an hour and a half.
It's up right now, by the way.
So record yourself a video. Record a video of yourself looking at the site.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And if the video lasts less than 5 minutes and you manage to tear yourself away from the site,
then post that video and see if you can find it.
You get a free email response from us if you email us, right?
That's how memes get started.
That's true.
I mean, people see that and they say, oh, this is a meme. This is the one of them is people eating a teaspoonful of cinnamon. You can't eat a teaspoonful of cinnamon.
Yeah.
Oh, you just will spit it out.
And the black hole just keeps sucking and sucking.
An hour later on GeekSpeak, we never get off the first story.
Switching back over to Wave. Hey, this week we're using Google Wave as our way of communicating together, and it's not as clean as Etherpad, but it's functional to some degree, and that's why I know that next is Miles. Hi.
Hi.
And what's going on with Roman?
Roman ingots of lead. So big chunks.
Yeah.
It's a big chunk of some material. Some
mineral.
And it's usually a metal.
Yeah, and it's naturally you find it pulled out of the ground. So like a gold.
Well, no,
nugget,
it's not heavily mined. It's after it's been processed, but before it's been formed into, for example, what the Romans used pipes and the like, or swords and actually you wouldn't want to make a lead sword. That would be really bad.
It would be dull.
But one thing that was very interesting about these Roman ingots that are about 2,000 years old, give or take, is that they're being used at a particle physics laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think, like, wait, why are they using
why that? Are these
wouldn't archaeologists want to have these? And the archaeologists do. But they're willing to pass it over because the this physics lab is going to be doing some spectroscopic analysis on it and isotopic analysis on it to find out where the material came from. When you look at a bit of material, you can find out where the location of the quarry was, in the original quarry.
Because there's actually going to be impurities, but also there's going to be different levels of I'm totally blanking on the isotopes. The isotope levels are going to be different depending on where it comes from.
But why would they care about it is the big question. The reason why is because if we mine lead right now and make it, there's a fair amount of lead trying to remember what the isotope name is, lead-210, sorry.
Okay.
And so it's mildly radioactive still.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2,000-year-old lead ingots that they just uncovered from underwater in the Mediterranean has a very – basically the radioactive isotope has a half-life of 22 years. So 2,000 years later, there really isn't any of it left. So when they're doing things like
– wait, why is it exist in the rock? The ore that we find now, because it's without the radioactive material?
Right.
Okay.
And But they're able to use it for items where they're looking for radioactivity, trying to detect it, or trying to find things where you're excluding radioactivity, anything that can mess up the equipment, and make a more clean environment by using these ingots that were made by Romans 2,000 years
ago. So they're not doing anything to them. They're just putting, they're just using them in the detector the way they are, or are they malforming them? And
well, chances are they probably will be forming them to a different shape. But it's unlikely they'd be able to use it in the exact same form because ingots in general are fairly irregular shape.
Right. So to be clear on why that's happening, my assumption is the reason why lead that's in the ground right now is still hot, has isotopes that are unstable, if you will, and are decaying, unlike lead, I think, is pretty stable.
Well, they're both lead. It's just different isotopes.
So I mean that lead itself doesn't, when it gets to the standard isotope, if you will, it's pretty stable. It probably doesn't even have a half-life. It doesn't break down at all, but maybe not. It doesn't transform into something else.
No, there are isotopes of lead that are radiometrically stable, yes.
Right, okay. So the non-radiometrically stable, the 22 half-life ones, are clearly being created more recently, right, within the last, 22 years, or at least half of them are. So the lead that's in the ore that's in the ground, I'm assuming there's other things around it that are breaking down into those isotopes of lead. It's being created, if you will, by other things breaking into it. But anyway, very cool. So they're using ancient lead. I didn't know that you needed ancient lead. That's cool.
Well, they in general didn't need it because they had to use something else. But now this is available, it's like a gold mine.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, lead into
a little bit less than a gold. Oh, man. Lindsay, hi. How's it going?
Pretty good. How's it going for you, Lyle?
Good.
Excellent.
What's up with Virgin Galactic?
So Virgin Galactic, Spaceship 2 completed its first captive flight.
What's a captive flight?
This is an interesting thing. So it basically, there's another spacecraft that carries it into the atmosphere. And so the spacecraft, which is called White Knight 2, kind of looks like two planes attached at the wing. And then the spacecraft is attached where the wings would attach. Can you visualize that?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so the spacecraft looks like you would expect one to look, you know, kind of like the shuttle.
Like the shuttle, right, like a thick plane.
Exactly. Yeah. But it all looks very spacecrafty.
Yeah.
Neat. I highly recommend looking up the pictures. There's some great pictures out there.
And Virgin Galactic is the kind of commercial spacecraft vehicle right now, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, to be, rather.
Right. So they've already taken in like $45 million in deposits from just citizens that want to go up when it does become commercially.
How much do you have to put in?
It says that was from more than 330 people. So I'm thinking, you know, like over $150,000 a pop. And that's a deposit.
Right.
Just to maybe hold a seat that might exist.
So the captive flight means that they actually did fly it with these other planes?
Right. So if you go look at the pictures, you'll see them all attached flying, which is pretty neat. It lifted off from Mojave Air and Spaceport, and the flight was nearly 3 hours and achieved altitude of about 45,000 feet.
How high is that? Does anyone know what the stratosphere starts at?
I can't remember.
Not sure. That's like 4-something miles.
Yeah, that's pretty high. Cool. Yeah.
So they're going to work on it through the rest of the year in 2011, and
space
they don't know yet
50.
When the first commercial flight will be.
Why is it that they're – I mean, traditionally we use giant propulsion systems and just take off from a dead standstill on the ground. Why are they doing this flight thing? Is it productive in some way?
I'm really not sure.
Really,
I'm
cool.
Guessing it's cheaper, but I don't
it's
know.
Probably about cost. You're right.
Right.
Yeah, thank you. Cool.
Sure.
Planets?
Yeah. While we're on the topic of space.
Sounds good.
So the accepted mechanism by which planets form around stars and solar system forms is basically you have all of this gas and dust in this disk, right? And it has some kind of net spin or something like that, right? And eventually it develops its own gravity pull. Most of the stuff goes in, forms this star. But then you also have a couple clumps of elements. They clump into planets that go around in the same direction as the original disk of gas and dust used to. Now, the effect of that is you end up with these stars which are rotating and these planets which are orbiting in that same direction. However, we very recently there was a study done, actually in like the last week and a half or something like that. And they're saying, you know, quote, this is a real bomb we're dropping into the field of exoplanets, which is that they've actually found in a sample of 27 exoplanets, which means planets outside of our solar system, they found that that six of these were orbiting in the opposite direction of the rotation of their host star, which is really...
Six out of how many?
Six out of 27 of the sample that they used.
That's a pretty large percentage, actually.
Yeah, that's over 20%, right? 6-12, yeah.
Interesting. How?
They don't quite know. I mean, they have a couple theories. One is that the planets that are orbiting the star weren't formed with the star, right?
Right.
And that would
later.
Be consistent with our current the current method by which we believe solar systems to be formed, where you have these hot Jupiters, these things that migrate toward these stars, right? They end up going the opposite direction. And whenever they get really close, then they're actually slowed because of gravitational mm-hmm. tidal forces, and eventually go into a roughly circular orbit over the period of millions and millions of years.
So we could have had one of those just as easily if something came in our solar system after its initial spin up. So the general, I mean,
conceivably.
I know you just described this, but I want to try to make it clear for my grandma. Uh-huh. Well, my grandma's really intelligent and understands this stuff probably better than me. Somebody that might not understand what we're talking about. So
yeah.
The early formation of a solar system, we think, is a large cloud of gas, and that gas basically condenses around a central point. And as it's pulled in, the gravitational force increases. And anyone that's ever been spinning on a spinning and pulls their arms in knows that as you pull their mass in the center, the thing starts to speed up faster and faster. Mm-hmm. Well, that basically generally causes a whirlpooling type effect in a direction, and it's kind of everything starts moving in the same direction because as things circle one direction, they bump into things, and everything has a initial one way. So in our solar mm-hmm. system, all our main bodies orbit one direction.
Yeah, and you end up with these big chunks of rock which end up clearing their orbit around, like by accruing all of this mass, and you end up with planets like the planets in our solar system.
I love that you said clearing the orbit, of course, because that's the one definite finding.
Well, that's one of the three, actually.
Right, well, yeah. That's the one that Pluto doesn't do.
Yeah. So. Yeah, Pluto's not a planet for that main yeah. primary reason is that there are so many things in its orbit which are as big as it almost.
Right.
Like its moon is almost as big as it, right?
Right, right.
Its moon doesn't orbit Pluto. Pluto and its moon orbit each other.
So that's the general theory. It would fit the same theories that they pulled in a new object later on and it just happened to be going a different direction after
yeah.
most of it's gone. What's another? Was there a new theory?
Not proposed in the article I read. I mean, it really does take a lot to derail a theory which is pretty well established, like the yeah. way we know planets or we believe planets form, right? So this is definitely not this. It hasn't disproven anything, not
right.
by a long shot, right?
The thing
but
is,
it definitely
we got to think about the sample set of how you find exoplanets. Larger planets are seen more easily.
Yes,
and there might be a side effect that when this occurs. When there's an object in the system rotating the opposite direction, it's actually easier to see the system for some reason because the body's actually larger.
Well,
if you imagine right now something came into our solar system and collided with something else and changed the direction right away, that new body would probably be bigger than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe now I'm not exactly sure why. I read somewhere in this article, I believe that the larger planets are actually more likely to get captured around other stars, right? If you have larger planets that end up getting captured around stars, it's more well. And yeah, exactly what you're saying, right? We are. It's a lot easier for us to detect the hot Jupiters, is what they're called. Really, really, really large planets that are kind of the size of Jupiter, right? Earth is itty bitty compared to Jupiter and compared to these other planets.
Well, we have found some Earth-sized things, right?
I don't think we have. We found a couple things that are close to Earth size. The Kepler mission will actually should. Show us some pretty cool things. The Kepler mission also uses the transit method, which is whenever a planet passes in front of its host star relative to our reference frame or point of view, then we see the star's brightness dip ever so slightly. And the Kepler mission is sensitive enough to detect something that's Earth-sized.
That was also a frequency shift of the star because of its movement.
No, that's a separate method. There's the transit method and there's the Weigel method.
Thank you, Ben, for planet forming yeah. theory stuff.
I think we found a planet that's like twice the size of Earth or something like that. That was a couple months ago, so
close enough if you've got really strong thighs.
We're discovering exoplanets so fast.
Speaking of things moving around, Al, what's up on that computer?
on my computer. I'm just trying to follow this Google Wave thing.
It's not working out for you. I want to talk about the track mouse.
Oh, yeah. This is a really, really neat thing. It's called MousePath. I think it's written in JavaScript. Not sure. But what this little program does is it keeps track of your mouse for the amount of time you have it running. So you turn the device on, and it will, and say you click with your mouse, it'll make a little black dot. and then you move your mouse, and it makes a thin line from where you moved your mouse to the next spot you move your mouse. Now, you can imagine the amount of clicking and moving and all that kind of stuff that happens when you're doing anything, like say you're working on Photoshop or you're, you know, anything, browsing the web. Mm-hmm. Well, this keeps track of all that stuff, and at any point you decide, hey, I wonder what this looks like. You go back to the application, and you see a picture of this entire sort of web with these dots and mm-hmm. all this network. And you can see the area that you've mostly clicked on, and it's a little bit darker. And they really look like sort of like modern art, like sort mm-hmm. of Pollock kind of drawings. And this is a free application.
It's very similar to the things that studies use for...
Yeah, it feels like that. Yeah. It feels a lot like, oh, most of the time you click on the upper left. The application was developed by a Russian designer named Antony Zenkov. And he just did it to brighten up his routine. But, you know, he said, oh, maybe anybody else will like this. So I downloaded it a couple weeks ago. And then right as Ben just started his story, I looked it up again just to make sure, oh, it didn't
still
go
working.
Away.
Sure.
And they actually have updated it, and I added another link there. And Great. It's actually even a little bit better. And I downloaded it and turned it on. In the time, oh, I mean, so I did everything from the time Ben started
plugin?
Talking. Huh?
Is it a Firefox plugin?
No, it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with the browser. It's just, and it runs on, you can get it for the Mac, and it also runs on Windows and Linux. Huh.
Yeah, it's really funny that you downloaded it while I was covering my story because I just launched it. I just downloaded it while Al was covering his story.
That's how fast you can get this and try it out.
Yeah, it's just... So the question would be, what about people who only use keyboard shortcuts, right? That's
right.
Like me, right? What do they do with their mouse? Not very much.
Well, then you'd see, based on the graph, that you don't use your mouse that much.
You could see how good you are at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, it's really a neat little thing. I think it's a lot of fun to play with this thing. So you should go and try it. It's free.
Geekspeak.org. Yep. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. Does anyone have a podcast or iPhone app of the week?
No. Oh, an iPhone app of the week.
Please.
Sure. I have an app that I just came across the other day.
Is it a drawing app?
It is not. It is actually a weather app.
Hmm.
And it is called My Weather Lite. And there's also a My Weather full version. So mm-hmm. if you don't want to have ads, it has that.
What's beneficial of it?
What's beneficial is that not only can you do everything that the Yahoo app that comes with the iPhone mm-hmm. does. In other words, you can have multiple locations and slide between them. But it has the long-term forecast up to, I believe it's a week. But mm-hmm. then again, you know, it's as good as
up
whatever.
Up until irrelevance.
As
yeah.
good as they can forecast.
Right. But what I really liked was the fact that you have a trend line to find out what's the temperature like going to be, for example, today at 3 p.m.? What's it going to be at 7 p.m.? And so you see this graph that shows as the temperature is going
what's
up and down.
What's the name of that app?
My Weather.
You know, and I have an app, too, I want to mention real quick. It's called the Touch Mouse. It's something that allows you to control your cursor from your iPhone. And it's by Logitech. And Apple makes one of these things too, but Apple's really not very good.
Do you know how it's done? Is it the accelerometer?
That it knows it's a touch screen. So basically the cursor appears on your phone. You can control, you can click, you can do everything. It's as if your trackpad has been transferred to your phone.
It's like a remote control kind
of thing. And a little app runs on your computer, and then the app runs on your phone. And this is free, by the way, which is weird, you know, but it's a free thing that actually works really well, better than Apple's. It's called a Logitech Touch Mouse.
Right. I've got an Android app. It's the built-in clock weather widget that you can put on your home screen. And it actually does a very similar thing as Miles was talking about, how it does a temperature graph over the course of the day. Very, very cool app.
Right. Well, a temperature graph and a precipitation, like when it's going to be raining at a certain time of the day and what the wind's going to be like, and we'll even calculate what the wind chill factor is.
We'll put all those cool apps for iPhone, and for Chrome.
Android,
up on geekspeak.org. Momentarily. You can hear us clicking away. We are now taking calls with questions about technology. The numbers are 833-212-1017. 831-476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, offering master's degree programs for geeks to become innovators of the future. UAT.edu/masters. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to GeekSpeak. In the air with me, I have Lindsay, Miles, Ben, and Al. Answering the phones is Rick Philman, as he does every week. And we did get a call in. We mentioned the 6% of exoplanet systems have reversed flowing planets, or one planet that's going the opposite direction.
6%? 20,
well, no,
said, over 20%.
We said 6 out of 20.
6 out of 20.
30%, according to one.
It's actually 28%.
No, a caller came in saying 30%.
I see that. Right. That's what I'm reading, but it's actually 28 or so. Anyway, that's why.
Yeah, but it's closer to 20.
Yeah. It's close to 30%.
30%.
Anyway, yes, and thank you, Hal, for that information.
Now, wait a second.
We can do more news as we're waiting for phones to come in, and I think the person that's up next is... Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Miles. Hi.
Hi. There's been a lot in the news about financial derivatives, or what's also known as collateralized debt obligations.
Oh, yeah.
And we've talked about... NPR's talked about it with regard to economics, and we've seen it in the news with regard to market shows and stuff like that. But I haven't seen many people talking about it from the point of view of mathematicians and computer scientists. Just so happens there's a result from Princeton, computer scientists and economics, that we're taking a look at it from a mathematics point of view. And we're finding that not only are they really hard to see, because a lot of people were saying, well, you should have taken a closer look at them. But someone who is acting as a bad actor trying to put in some problem items in along with the stable mortgages, it turns out that trying to look for that, trying to find that, is an NP-complete problem. NP-complete, standing for non-deterministic polynomial time.
Of course.
So to put this into context, a deterministic polynomial, or usually just termed a polynomial complete problem, is something that you can say, oh, if I have 100 items, it's going to finish in, you know, a certain number, a maximum of, you know, what is it, 10 to the 5 steps.
It's kind of a way to it's kind of a way to approximate how hard it would be to come up with a solution.
Yes. Okay. In algorithm design, you have things like people refer to O of n, O log n, mm-hmm. And it's a determination of if you have a certain number of items, like you have a list of Social Security numbers, whatever, how long will it take you to find that Social Security number that you're looking for?
So an idea like this is if in the Ben Lomond area prefix of 336, 831-336, mm-hmm. there's only actually a little under 10,000 numbers and actually less than that. Because some of the numbers are reserved. So if you wanted to find somebody, you really would only have to call 10,000 people.
No, it's not talking about that.
But that's the end thing, right?
The idea is no matter how many you have a good idea of how long it's going to take you to solve it even before you start solving it.
By saying if n is the number,
because it's
it takes you this
because
long to solve
it. Because it's a particular type of problem that you've seen before that you can identify.
Got it.
A non-deterministic polynomial complete problem is one where you can't be sure that you're going to be able to solve this with all the computing power in the world in the next trillion years, depending upon the size of the subset of the size of the data.
Wow. So and that's for
the idea is you have no idea. It could be like you could stumble upon the solution tomorrow, or you could never come across a solution.
And this is for financial derivatives. That's true.
And this is true for this type of CDOs that were the heart of the financial crisis, is that it's a type of problem that comes up that even if you everything comes crashing down, mathematically you can't go back and even prove in court after the fact that that CDO was put together with bad actors involved.
Gotcha.
It really changes the course of it. It's not just
you must have heard the same show on this recently, describing it. What podcast was that?
I'm sorry, I did not.
You didn't hear a great description? I think it was This American Life did a thing, but the Money Guys, I think, did it. Anyway, it's incredible to talk about the complexities actually involved. Yeah, it was This American Life, the most recent episode.
Right, but this isn't about regulators like just taking a closer look. This is
right.
About even if you put all the computers in the world on it, they may not be able to do their job. That's how untenable these things are.
Humans are complicated.
And thanks. CDOs even more so.
Thank you so much. Lindsay, what's going on with CERN?
All right. CERN's LHC, the particle collider.
It does light up particles.
it began its subatomic exploration for the first time on 330. So after 16 years, $10 billion, and 2 false starts due to electrical failures, the LHC finally started to make subatomic particles collide. So, you know, they broke out the champagne, everybody danced, mm-hmm. It was great. Protons were accelerated to more than 99% of the speed of light to record high energy levels of 3.5 trillion electron volts apiece. They raced around the 17-mile underground magnetic track outside of Geneva, Switzerland, and the particles crashed together inside of apartment building-sized detectors designed to capture every detail from the resulting collisions. Their top goals are finding the identity of the dark matter that shapes the visible cosmos, mm-hmm. and finding the particle known as the Higgs boson, you know, also known as the God particle. It's thought to give other particles mass.
Right.
So until now, nobody's been able to see these things.
Cool. We haven't found that yet, of course.
Right.
That's not quite.
Wait, there it is. Oh, it's gone.
But the world didn't end like everybody said it
would. I swear I saw it.
Unless we're just on a different tangent and we never noticed.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you'd like to ask us questions about or comment about our show, please feel free to do so. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Thank you, Lindsay. Al, let's go ahead and talk about Google.
Google, yeah. They're coming out with Google Cloud Print. The idea here is that you have all these devices, like, for example, the iPad, but you've also got, you know, BlackBerries and all these different phone things and all that, but there's really no way to print from them. Actually, printing in general is kind of a pain because you need print drivers. You need all these different kinds of things. There's all different kinds of printers. Well, Google has set out to try to address this problem in what they call Cloud Print. It's going to be part of the Chromium and Chromium OS projects. Mm-hmm. And Cloud Print aims to allow any type of application to print to any printer. And so that would include web, desktop, mobile apps, any kind of device, really, BlackBerry, Windows, machines, Macs, iPads, any of that stuff. So you'll be able to just take your device and just print. So there's no print stack and there's no printer drivers to do it.
Yeah, because everything's going through Google servers at that point, right?
Right.
So if you print to your home office computer right next to you, the data actually gets sent off to Google servers mm-hmm. and then it gets sent back.
Yeah, so they'll be using like a web-based API to communicate directly with these cloud-aware printers. Another aspect of Google being able to find everything out that you're doing. Yeah. It does seem like a handy thing. Printing is sort of a pain. It's gotten better over the years, but it has... it is sort of a pain to have to get to set up a new printer. I'm going through it right now.
That's nice that you don't have to deal with drivers really anymore that. But I don't know. It makes me a little bit uncomfortable to have not just my web traffic, but also the things that I decide to print. Like if I decide to print a document that I authored and has never seen the web, that goes through Google servers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I don't know.
A little creepy if they're going to track that, which they probably will.
Do you think instead of having something like chat roulette, they're going to have print roulette? You can just turn on your printer and see what comes up.
Someone's trying to print. Lucky.
Yeah, really.
I want to print one document on my computer. I'm feeling lucky. Just let it go.
Or I want to print one document. Who knows whose printer it will print to, right?
Yeah.
Your print is done in 7 miles.
It'll be the new, what do you call that thing? The form letter that you send out. That everybody, you know, you keep repeating it. What's that called again? That kind of letter? Chainmail.
Chainmail,
yeah. It'll be the chainmail printing.
Armored printing?
It could be the worst kind of spam.
That sounds like a horrible idea.
This sounds like a horrible story.
Like the spam, it's leaving my screen now.
Yeah.
Tonight, I'm not going to Steve Loffer's art show. Let me mention, Steve Loffer is a web developer here, and he's got a landscape art piece show, and it's pretty geeky. He does micro art and then explodes it big and prints it, and it's really kind of beautiful black and white stuff, at least the most of the stuff I've seen. And he's doing a show tonight from 5 to 8 in Davenport at the Davenport Gallery. You can find information about this at geekspeak.org. Of course, if you're in the Davenport area or can get there easily, go see his art show. That's a little plug for a guy that's pretty geeky and fun and is normally behind the scenes. And then also tonight, the thing I'm going to is the Graduate Recital Hall. Philip Lampriski is a composer and digital music artist, and he has an interactive table, which is like a projected light table that has sensors around it and plays music that way. He also has a guitar that he's rigged up with a it's an acoustic guitar with an actual electric guitar strings on it and a pickup for every string, and that goes into a patch of Maximus P programming that he's done that detects every single note that's played on every string, so he can play with himself in loop, and it's going to be a pretty amazing graduate recital piece, I'm sure. And that's tonight at the recital hall at UCSC, the Music Center Recital Hall. Starting at 7:30, and that's a free event. And I'm sure the gallery thing for Steve Loffer is a free event. And this information you can find out at geekspeak.org in about 10 minutes. Next news story, because unless we've got calls. We got calls, Ben? Are you on the...
I'm not sure if we have calls.
Let me see.
But I'm ready.
Yes, we do.
We do have calls. Oh, my gosh.
This Google Wave thing is really... I can't really get it. I'm so used to Etherpad, I don't even know where I am anymore.
You're in Santa Cruz.
Okay.
About a block from the beach.
That much I know.
Mike, too.
Don't let me forget to move my car.
Oh, that's right. Parking reinforcements and hey, let's go ahead and talk to Justin in Santa Cruz. Welcome.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Love the show.
Thanks.
Thanks. I have a question. I've been wanting to pull down some YouTube footage and edit it in Final Cut Express, and I don't know how to do that. I've done a little bit of research, and it looks like there are programs out there, but I wanted to consult you guys so I don't waste a bunch of time. With things that don't work.
Are you saying we waste time to figure this stuff out?
So we waste time, so you don't have to.
Yes.
Ben, speaking of wasting time, Ben.
Okay, I'll help. I'll waste your time. No. So I have a really good workflow that works. I have a workflow that works really well for me. There are indeed a lot of tools out there. You can download tools to take YouTube clips off the internet, and it'll convert it for you and everything like that. What I like to do personally, there are also web applications actually, which will convert it on their servers and then send it to you. But what I like to do is what you do is you open up the YouTube clip in Safari. And then if you go to the window menu, there's an activity window. And in the activity window, you can see all of the assets which are on the page, all of the images, all of that kind of stuff.
This exists in Firefox as well.
In Firefox.
I have a really good solution for this, by the way. So.
Okay. But what you do is then you find the FLV file. That's the actual video file that is being downloaded to your computer. If you double-click on it, it'll download that FLV. And then you can convert that however you want to any video format you want with a tool called MPEG Stream Clip, and that's also free.
MPEG Stream Clip. Do you know if that's a multi OS?
Yeah, I think it's all the three main ones.
I think so.
And the thing I like about that is you don't lose any quality because you don't have anyone converting it for you.
Right.
And then you're converting it from whatever they sent you. Most people download YouTube clips to put them on iPods or on iPhones or things like that. But if you want to actually edit with it, then you want the highest quality possible, so right. That's the way I would do it.
All right, now let's try Alice's approach.
I do this all the time, and I use Video Download Helper 4.7.3. It's a Firefox plugin, so you're going to have to use Firefox. But this thing, and it puts a little icon on your browser, and when you're on a page that has the video, you just watch the video. The video has to completely load. So if you're in YouTube, you know how there's that little buffer zone that's loading. You got to make sure the thing's already loaded. You don't have to watch it, but you just have to make sure the whole thing's loaded. You click this little button, and then you can select to download the actual source. It'll tell you the actual size. It'll do the conversion for you if you want. It'll save it as MPEG or iPhone. It'll do all different kinds of things. I do this all the time, and for me, this is the simplest way and the fastest way to do it. It's called Video Download Helper. It's also free, but unlike Ben's solution, this you have to use Firefox because it only works in Firefox.
Okay, that's great. I do use Firefox, and can you give me some advice on what format to put it in so I can? What's the best format to edit in Final Cut Express?
If you're doing, if you're downloading standard definition, which means that it looks more like a square than a wide rectangle. Right, a 4:3 aspect ratio, then you probably would just be fine converting it to DV, DV NTSC 29.97 frames per second. And if you, you can listen back if you missed that. And if you're doing HD, then you can just do HD, HDV, 1080i, something like that.
Okay.
And those are plugins that are very, very well adapted to editing with Final Cut. So that's why you want to compress into those. Either that or Apple Animation, but those are huge, huge file sizes, so you probably want to stay away from that.
Thank you for the call.
Sure.
Those links will be up on geekspeak.org, too.
As will everything we talk about, almost.
I don't know if I'm typing all that down.
No, not all that. The show's there, but the links.
Yeah.
All right. In Watsonville, Fred, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question or comment?
I wanted to bring up the issue that's resulted from the Ning network going to a paid model, and there are at least a dozen Ning networks that I'm part of as an educator, and the education community really has enthusiastically embraced Nings, and now people are in big trouble because there's no simple export option, and there's no clear alternative that has anything like the same ease of use that the Nings had. So I wanted to just put out what, if first of all, if this guy has come on everybody's radar, and what suggestions you have.
So let me describe first off what Ning is. Everybody understands the idea of Facebook or a social network place that people talk about things, right? And Ning, it's just Ning.com, is a company, I'm assuming, that actually allows you to make a network around your topic. So let's say you're really interested in South American water buffalo and a lot of other people involved, then you make a Ning for that, and you now have your group of people that are really interested in that, and that's where the whole thing is circled around. It's great for like a classroom or even a school, so that you can kind of only invite the people you want to invite and then have all the features of like a Facebook, but it's kind of contained. And then it's not a public thing and you get that kind of security, but also a lot of sharing and creativity. So that's what the Ning network does. You can make one. It's been free for a long time.
Yeah, it's a forum, a blog, a message system, email.
Photo sharing.
Yeah.
The works. And now they're going to say we're going to start charging for it, which makes sense. They want to make money probably. They don't. Have you looked into what the education costs would be for it? I mean, is it going to be too expensive for you?
Well, yes, because anything above free is too expensive for most educators. The only reason that the education community embraced it was that it was free, and it's not just there are many that use that private network feature, but most of the ones that I'm part of, and the reason it's been so enthusiastically adopted, is for educators' personal learning networks and networking publicly and globally around various education topics has just been hugely popular. The whole education community, I don't think that very many personal, educators who aren't administrators of big organizations are going to want to say, oh, sure, I'll pick up $5 a month or $15 a month or whatever.
Well, they're not saying, I'm looking through their press releases, and they're not saying how much it's going to cost. There's
right,
no,
that's the unknown.
There's nothing in there. They're saying they're going to charge. They're going from 100% free service to a paid service, but they haven't come out with plans or price points or any of that stuff yet. So,
yes, and they're also saying, oh, we're concerned about all the educators' uses and so on, but I don't put much stock in them being able to come up with some model that's going to allow them to continue educational uses for free. So,
well, maybe they will. I mean, these are all unknowns.
And there are other solutions out there, and though Ning's going to go to a paid model, there's also SocialGo, ELGG, I don't know how you pronounce that, and Igloo, E-G-L-L-L-O-O, excuse me. Those are also options that are similar to Ning, but they might go to paid as well. I mean, the truth is that someone's got to pay the bills. I would hope, I mean, this is the way I would want Ning to do this, right? I want Ning to say, you know what, if this is a primary support for an education facility, a public school, for example, any public schools can use them, period, right? That for free. And then we're going to get the model from other groups. That makes a lot of sense. The thing that concerns me is that I think that if they do a paid model, I mean, the question really comes down to who pays it, right? If you've got 500 people using the site, but one person created it, some of these people care and some of these people don't care. But the only reason it really works is it's easy to get in it and involved. If there's a fee, it's not going to grow anymore, right? I don't know if I want to be a part of it unless I'm a part of it already. You know,
there is actually another issue with Ning, because there are other options. Mm-hmm. But the issue is that people have invested a whole lot of time. There's no way to easily export all that data
off
of Ning.
All the data is locked.
Well, they also offer one service where it allows you to take your whole Ning network and put it within your own website. So it's actually your domain, and then this whole Ning thing appears. So it's a
but
web
you're
service.
But you're forwarding your domain to them, I think, to do that.
Oh, you're proxying.
I think so, okay. But I'd have to look at
I don't
how
think
doing.
So. Good Charlotte does it, the band Good Charlotte.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. I'm going to keep on top of Ning because I think it's a very interesting topic. So thanks for giving us a ring, and we'll hopefully they'll have a solution for educators. If I find one, I'll mention it on the show.
I also wanted to chime in on the question about Etherpad.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding, at least, and I haven't delved into this really deeply, but it looks and feels like what Google has done is to take some of the Etherpad functionality now that they've bought them and throw it into their new drawing document feature, where in the draw document, sort of like the old Apple Works
drawing
program, you can throw anything of any kind up in a draw document.
Yeah, and in fact, Google's actually integrating Etherpad in general throughout their systems. So we're going to see the features of Etherpad, which is a multi-editing capabilities that are pretty cool through JavaScript, HTML5, show up in Google Docs as well. And I think it's actually kind of already being implemented. I haven't tested it out. So that's true. The thing that was nice, the things that are nice about Etherpad that we really liked was the simplicity to some degree. We kind of got used to it. But, you know, we're changing. We're geeks. We develop and change all the time. That's what you have to do when you're a geek. You have to learn something, get really good at it, and then find out the next thing and do the next one. And that's kind of that's what's exciting about being a geek, I think. So I think that Wave's not going to happen. The one that we're using, it doesn't work for our purposes. There are other alternatives. Maybe I'll write something, you know. But thank you thanks for the call.
All right.
All right. Take care. In just a second, Al's crazy USB of the week live. But first, Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Geek Speak is copyright Creative Commons. Share and share alike. You can do whatever you want with it. With the audio of the show, as long as you give us credit in your work and you share your work like we share ours. Contact me if you have questions about reusing our show content or in your own work or just rebroadcasting the show in general. We love that idea. Do you make music? We'd like to share your creative endeavors. Record a GeekSpeak themed song and we'll air it on KOSP and on our wildly successful podcast on geekspeak.org and NPR as well, of course. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. And the Puppet Master himself gives us permission to use it every week, which is very nice of him. Today, the geeks were Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe and Lindsay Lonnie and Lyle Troxel, that's me, and Al Luckow. Hi, Al.
Hi. This is Al, and I'm here with Geek Speak's crazy USB device of the week. It seems there is no end to these USB devices. Today's device is called a golf fidget. It's like a tiny golf ball. Well, half a golf ball, actually, and it sits in a little green disc with a USB cable coming out of it that is, of course, plugged into your computer. Basically,
this is more functional than the bowling ball one.
Well, I don't know. I'd question that.
Okay.
Basically, you press the ball, and it puts a bouncing blip on your computer screen, kind of like Pong did, but this has no paddles, and there's no other player, and there's no score. And so that's what it does. And I found a game like this, call it a game, but that it's exactly the same, but it's got a soccer ball in the disc instead of a golf ball. And it's exactly the same thing. But, you know, it's a soccer ball. And there's another one, too. It's a basketball. And it's exactly the same thing. Blip, blip. I don't make these things up. They're real. Well, you can see the links up at geekspeak.org after the show.
Thank you. We have 40 seconds. I don't understand it. It shows this thing on the screen that's the ball?
It's just a little square that goes beep, beep, and it goes back and forth, and you press this thing to start the beeping of this dot that flies back. It's Windows only, and it's just a USB. I mean, what do they think? What can we do with this USB thing, and we don't know what to do with it? Well, how about making it a golf ball? You know, have another meeting. Hey, a new meeting. Let's make it a basketball. Whole nother product, you know. It's actually the same size. They just paint it differently.
For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxel. We'll see you next week.